seated.
Thank you, Kim, and the rest of your team up there. Great to be blessed in worship. And worship does is intended to touch our hearts and put us in connection with God, and we have come with that intention. Well, we're going to looking at a parable. We're viewing a series on the parables, and today we have the parable of what is captioned often as the parable of the rich fool. So let's read the story and then move on to some reflections on that story. Luke chapter 12, verse 13, it says, "Then someone called from the crowd, 'Teacher, please tell my brother to divide my father's estate with me.' Jesus replied, 'Friend, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as that?' And then he said, 'Beware, guard against every kind of greed. Life is not measured by how much you own.' Then he told him a story. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced fine crops. He said to himself, 'What should I do? I don't have room for all my crops.' Then he said, 'I know. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have room enough to store all my wheat and other goods. And I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored away for years. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But then God said to him, 'You fool, you will die this very night. Then who will get everything you work for?' Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth but not have a rich relationship with God." Then turning to his disciples, Jesus said, "That is why I tell you not to worry about everyday life, whether you have enough food to eat or clothes to wear. For life is more than food and your body more than clothing. Look at the ravens. They don't plant or harvest or store food in barns, for God feeds them, and you are far more valuable to him than any birds. Can all your worries add a single moment to your life? And if worry can't accomplish a little thing like that, what's the use of worrying over bigger things?" Well, the parable and the story hardly needs commentary, and one hesitates to say anything about it for fear of destroying the impact of it. Most of us, I suspect, have had moments when we fantasize about being rich. Most of us probably have hummed the tune in our mind, "If I had $1 million, I'd..." Well, think about it. Let's make that 10 million. 1 million isn't really that enough, really, right? In our, you know, speaking of greed, let's just talk about, never mind a million, let's move to 10 million. What would you do if you'd have $10 million dropped into your bank account? You know, even though we've heard that money comes with problems attached to it, most of us say, "Well, I'd like to have that kind of a problem," right? Have you ever said that? "Yeah, I'd like that problem." See, there's something seductive and sinister about money. The pervasive lotteries, of course, give us lots of stories what does happen when people all of a sudden have fabulous amounts of money in their account. I don't know what the percentage is, but I do know that there are quite a few lottery winners that later, they rue the day of winning the lottery. It did not make them more happy. In fact, in many cases, it comes to, you know, you could say it ruins their life and their enjoyment of life. Well, this parable speaks about having more than enough of prosperity. And I think we need to kind of put ourselves on a level playing field here. Now, it is true that our net worth varies, but in our being born in Canada, we all won the lottery by being able to be here, and so all of us have more than we need, more than the basics of life. And so I think the application of this parable applies to all of us. It's about how we handle our prosperity, how we handle that surplus, that which is beyond and above our basic needs, our basic clothing need and housing needs. What do we do with that? Well, the man that Jesus presents to us in this story would be judged by most people to be an eminently successful person. He has all the marks of a good businessman, and yet God calls him a fool. And so that's a powerful term. And the Bible reserves that term for people that make egregious mistakes. You have to be a big-time loser to get that title pinned on you. Just a quick overview of cases where that appellation is used. We go to 1 Samuel 13:12. Where Saul judges himself and he says, I have played the fool. Well, if you read the story of King Saul, you'd say, you're right, Saul. Psalm 14 verse 1 says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And so that's the Bible's judgment of atheism. Proverbs 1:7 says, fools despise wisdom. And then in Proverbs 7, we have the story of a young man who is taken captive by a prostitute. And it says, suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the disciplines of a fool. Proverbs 14 verse 9 said, fools mock at sin. Then in Romans chapter 1, describing the people who abandon God's morality and God's value system, it says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Well, the parable invites us to think about God's judgment in calling this man a fool, and encourages us to develop a strategy to avoid being a fool in God's eyes. And so I have from this parable, I took what to me were the obvious lessons and said, we're going to just think about that and maybe God's Spirit will apply it to our hearts. And in the end, I don't want anyone to feel judged, but I want us to plead for God's mercy. Lord, have mercy on us. Help us to be wise with all the abundance and with the surplus that you give each one of us, and that we'll manage it well. So the strategy number one, we must curb the greed that lurks within us. The parable was spoken in response to a young man who wanted help in settling his inheritance with his brother. And this young man seems to come bursting. Jesus is busy teaching the crowd, and he has all the marks of being a spoiled, overindulged child. And he thinks he should be able to just step right to, never mind waiting in line to have your question answered. No, this kid just marches right to the front of the line and he says, here's my question. My brother won't give me my share of inheritance. Tell him to give it to me. And it's as if the brother was there. Jesus answers to them both and says, who made you friend? Who made me a judge over you? He's somewhat harsh in his response and kind of pushes the man aside. But Jesus, knows that no matter how he divides that estate, unless you deal with the greed, which is the heart problem, it wasn't an issue. It was not an accounting problem that he was looking to a solution for. He needed a heart change. See, as long as we have the grasp, all of us know of examples, I would expect, of where inheritance issues have caused division and hurt and grief in families, and sometimes permanently. Sometimes people just can't get over it because greed. What is it that makes inheritance issues such a hot button item? Well, I can't think of anything other than it stirs up the greed in us. The idea of getting something that we could have and it's a nasty thing, the problem of greed. So another way of putting this man's issue when Jesus kind of shoves it aside, it's like this guy is saying, teacher, my dad died and he had a lot of toys, and my brother got more toys than I do, and I want my, and that's not fair. I want my share of the toys. And then Jesus kind of deals with the issue is greed. And see, Jesus isn't interested in ballooning this guy's bank account, but he's interested in giving him a value system that will help him to enjoy the wealth that he inherited and preserve his relationship with his brother, although that is not directly addressed in the story. But when you all of a sudden let go and you give up greed, it makes it possible for you to have a relationship, even if you think you didn't get quite as much as you thought was your share. Warren Wiersbe, preacher, author, radio pastor, makes this interesting statement about this man's request. He says, like too many people today, he wanted Jesus to serve him, but not to save him. And I think that it can be such a problem. How many people really want God to serve them rather than to change them and refine them? They want... And basically, we so often want God to make our life trouble-free. We want God to help us to have an easy life, to have no problems in life. And so we plead for God to help us solve the problems, our financial problems, our health problems, our relationship problems. And we want God to rescue us from the consequences of bad decisions and actions we committed earlier. But the idea is we come to God and we want him to serve us, to make our life easy and problem-free. And then when God doesn't come through for us, often people badmouth him. And they are bitter against him. And they use it as an excuse for abandoning him and turning away from him. And how, you know, just how evil is that? This young man has a problem of greed, and Jesus wants to deal with that. He wants to change his heart. And he puts it into perspective with this phenomenal advice. Don't be greedy for what you don't have. Real life is not measured by how much you own. Now, there's something we ought to put on our bathroom mirror and look at it every day. Real life is not measured by what we own. And yet so much of life tends to be in the direction of acquiring more. I came across a statement a couple of weeks ago. I came across this statement and I kind of put it in my little notebook of quotes. And it fits this. It really is a restatement of this. It says, the richest person is not the one who has the most, but the one who needs the least. And I think that's a nice turn on this, to realize riches doesn't come from having more things. I heard an old story from Britain. A boss overheard his servant say to a co-worker, if I had 5 pounds, then I'd be perfectly happy. Well, this prompted the boss to do an experiment. He walked into the room where this sentence had been uttered, and he said to the servant, I heard you say that if you had 5 pounds, you'd be perfectly happy. I want you to be perfectly happy. Here's 5 pounds. I hope it will make you happy. He then walked out of the room and listened at the door to see if there'd be any conversation. What did he hear the servant say? I should have said 10 pounds. You see, can you relate to that? You kind of have an idea of what you want, and then when you get it, you hardly pause to even think about it. You're moving on to the next thing. Now, I don't want to traumatize you by a personal confession, but I'm embarrassed to think how often that's happened to me. I think back, you know, I set out a goal, be it a financial goal or a career goal, and then when that happens, I just haven't paused there to celebrate that and just to be content the minute you raise the bar and you want more. And that's our fallen human nature. Every one of us, I believe, needs to look at greed and renounce it, as Jesus warns us in this passage. Greed seems to be baked into the human DNA. And sooner or later, each one of us are going to deal with it in some way. Now, for some, it might be money directly. You want that bank account. You're just looking at the savings account. And you say, if I'd have, you know, this much money in the bank, I'd feel secure and safe. Or if I'd have, you know, X number. So for some, it's money directly. For some, it's money, the things money buys. You know, whether it's clothes or whether it's jewelry, whether it's real estate or whether it's automobiles or whether it's gadgets. See, unless we learn to curb greed, our excesses will never lead us to have joy. We will not have the joy that contentment brings. Now, on the idea of being greedy, I was thinking for some it might be greedy for experiences, greedy for adventure. And I think the addiction scene is in that category, where people don't learn to curb their wants, and those excesses, it drives them to excess, and so there is a sense of greed in that regard. Greed and covetousness pose a barrier to our relationship with God, which gives us a clue. If you're dissatisfied with your relationship with God, and we as pastors often have people expressing that, coming, you know, I just don't know, I'm not getting anywhere in my Christian life, or I'm not growing, and that people have this dissatisfaction with where they're at spiritually. Well, if you're dissatisfied with your relationship with God, you need to put greed on the checklist of possible obstacles to your relationship with God, because of this passage and others make it clear that greed and covetousness will be a barrier, and it can stop us from God. So we have to combat greed. Well, how do we combat greed? Well, one thought that came to me, and now I don't want to say it's only an intellectual problem, but there is an intellectual dimension to solving the problem of greed. We have to face up to the ugliness of greed. You know, when you look at greed as always wanting more, when you look at it, say that you're, if I'd say that I'm a person, I'm never satisfied. I'm never content. No matter how much I want, I always want more. Well, that's not just ugly. It's positively ungodly. Who would want to say, I want to be a person that's never satisfied, never content? Well, I don't think any one of us would want to do that. No, we want the inner peace and the enjoyment of life. And you can't have that when greed is stirring you to keep reaching for more, so that you have to leave that in the hands of God. And the final paragraph makes that very clear, that Jesus wants us to have a trust in Him. We combat greed, that's one way. Also, we combat greed by understanding the burden that things bring into a life and the burden that wealth brings into our life. Diane and I, when we travel once in a while, listen to audiobooks, and on our last trip, we were listening to John Grisham's book, The Summons. Well, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but to compress it very, very tightly, it's a story about a competent, successful university professor in his middle age, and he's comfortable, he's tenured, he has a tenured position at a prestigious university, and his life is going along just swimmingly. And then his father dies and leaves him an inheritance. He has one younger brother who's a drug addict. He's in and out of rehab. So the brother, so he figured they'll get a modest inheritance. And when he goes to his brother, and he's the executor, he goes to the father's study and mucks around there, and he finds two boxes full of $1,000 bills. Like, it's a couple of $1 million in cash that nobody knew about it, and he's sure his brother didn't know about it. And then he has this moral dilemma. He says, if I share this one with my brother, it's going to just accelerate the path of ruin for him. No way, I'm not going to give that to him. I'm just going to keep this money out of the will and divide the rest of it, and I'll have this money. And so The story then unfolds of how his whole life is consumed with trying to hide this money, what to do with his money, and his life is ruined as a result of it. And going from a contented, successful guy, he's all of a sudden from this guy who's compromising all his values and is just distraught by it, and it ruins his life. Yes, that's how... it's the burden of wealth, the burden of things. You know, how enthusiastically we complicate our lives with things and in the pursuit of money. Diane and I have a custom, kind of a daily routine that we watch the national news together. And then we always watch the commercials that come on. We haven't got the technology yet figured out how we can watch the news without... Some people tell me they watch the news without the commercials, but we're not quite that advanced in our technology. So we watch the commercials as well. Well, there's this one commercial that kind of got our attention and stirred up some covetousness in us. We all started greeting for this product. And, you know, one of the problems of getting old is your eyesight kind of goes. You get dim and, you know, you need reading glasses. And some of you are already at that stage, even though none of you are as advanced in age as I am. But so you understand that only gets worse and it's annoying. And so here's this product that seems to, be an answer to the loss of eyesight. And it's called Zoomy Glasses. So... Diane, I'd say, you know, we should get Zoomy glasses because you could bird watch, you could thread a needle, you could read fine print. They're magical glasses. And so Diane comes home bouncing into the house last week, and she says, guess what? I found the Zoomies that we want. Oh, great. So we unpackaged the Zoomy. I put on the Zoomy. You know, for the life of me, I can't get them focused. They're junk. They're junk. We've got two pairs of Zoomies now. It is just to me, they represent and symbolize so many things that we buy with great hope and anticipation, and it turns out to be a huge disappointment. Unfortunately, this was only a $12 investment, so it didn't ruin us financially, but you know, we have to save a little bit to make up for that. But it's sometimes it can be large, it can be small, but Jesus is trying to protect us from being too quick to go buying stuff, because every item we bring home complicates our life, and God wants us to kind of declutter our lives. And just joy what you have. Because what did he say? He puts it this way. Real life is not measured by how much we own. I love that statement. And so he wants us to have the enjoyment of life. And so if our incomes are smaller, don't worry. What do you want to do with the end? We're not struggling to meet our grocery bill or to meet our housing costs in most cases. But it kind of curbs all the other things, the stuff and the vacations. And all those things can complicate life. But that's not a judgment. I don't want to put a judgment that all consumerism is sin. But I think it can lead that way, and we need to guard on it. Well, strategy number one in this, guard against greed. Greed for more things and greed for more money. Greed for more adventure. Greed for more experiences. All those things can destroy our relationship with God. Well, so the second strategy, don't succumb to the self-centeredness that God that wants to control us. Note that this man is not scolded for being wealthy, but he's scolded for desiring to accumulate wealth solely for his own enjoyment. Just notice this his statement here. So he said, "I know I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have room to store everything. I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry." Well, this farmer, this individual, has a shocking sense of a lack of creativity in deciding what he's going to do with the surplus, with the abundance. His going forward plan is focused entirely on himself. In his 61-word soliloquy, he uses the word I and my a dozen times. It seems he has no world beyond himself. He said, I know, I'll tear down, I'll build, I'll have enough, I'll sit back, I'll say to myself. You see, he's so self-centered, he even talks to himself. Twice in these two verses, we have, I'll say to myself. It's like he has no friends. I'll say to myself, friend, and he's talking to him, he's his own friend. I'll say to myself, friend, do this, I'll do this. Here's the secret. If you want friends, live a selfish life and you drive friends away. So this guy has been selfish. He's been thinking about himself, and there's no one around when he's talking about the philosophy of life. So he's talking to himself. And here's a lesson that if you want to make good decisions, you better have some input rather than just talking to yourself. We need God's input. We need to pray, God, what do you want me to do? We need to talk to godly people around us. Husbands need to talk to their wives and wives to their husband. We need to talk to one another to get the input. If you're just doing it by yourself, if you're just talking to yourself, the likelihood of talking yourself into some very bad choices is very high. See, this man congratulates himself, pats himself on the back, feeling smug, secure, and proud. He speaks as if it was all his doing. He forgot that he does not control the weather. He did not create the fertile soil. He wasn't really in charge of his own health entirely. And he wasn't responsible for the grain that had the life in it that sprouted. No, he's gloating like he did it all. He has no world beyond himself. He's not thinking about, I've got all this abundance. What are the needs around me? What about the needy, the homeless, the sick? What can I do to help them? What about the missionaries, the church, the charities? None of those are on his radar screen. And the tragedy is that he has reduced his enjoyment of life and squandered it in many ways. Sharing and giving breaks the bondage that selfishness brings. Selfishness shrinks our world. And here's the man who's built a claustrophobic cubicle where the air is stale and oxygen deprived. But God wants us to have an enjoyment of life. He wants us to love and give and serve and sacrifice and have adventure and to live large, not just to live in a small, selfish world of ourselves. God has a plan for us to make our life rich and meaningful, and we do that when we include Him in how we administer the surplus in our lives. The third strategy, make a priority of nurturing your relationship with God. But God said to him, you fool, you will die this very night, then who will get it all? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth but not have a rich relationship with God. Well, in the flash of a lightning bolt, everything changes for this man's story when he hears the announcement, tonight you will die, then who will get it? Jesus does not say the man's a fool for accumulating wealth. Jesus does not indiscriminately condemn wealth. But the Bible frequently warns about the misuse of wealth and possessions, but does not condemn being wealthy. And Jesus, in his lifetime, hung out with people who were people of above the middle class for his society. This man is a fool not because of what he did, but because of what he left undone. Yes, accumulating is one thing, but then not using it for God, that's what the real problem was for this man. That verse 21. Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth but not have a rich relationship with God. I love that phrase, a rich relationship with God. It's an interesting play on words, isn't it? To use the word rich in your relationship with God as opposed to rich in material things. And so what would it look like? What is a rich relationship with God like? Does it interest you? Does it look attractive, appealing, desirable? In the Greek, it says rich en theos, which is rich in God or rich into God. And I think we've all met people who would say, well, I'm not really into God right now. God's kind of on the back burner. Well, the very fact that you are here today tells me that you are into God. You desire a rich relationship with God. And so together we want to stir up our imagination. What does it look like to have a rich relationship with God? Well, I can only speak briefly. Really, the entire Bible is a handbook on how to have a rich relationship with God. And if we go to the New Testament, we say, to have a rich relationship with God, number one, you have to make sure that you are in a relationship with God. And we need to be reconciled to God through Jesus Christ. Remember the words of Jesus to Nicodemus. He says, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. So there has to be a spiritual beginning. Call it being born again or being saved or becoming a follower of Jesus. And the Bible refers to that process as going from darkness to light, or from death to life. So now, for some people, it's a very dramatic moment, and for others, it's a more gradual thing. But a rich relationship with God is based on having been reconciled to God through Jesus Christ, and you've said yes to the call of God, and you know that you are a follower of Jesus. That's the beginning point. And then after on, you build on it. And to have a rich relationship with God, it has to be a love-based relationship. A relationship of mutuality where you feel God's love and you give love back to God. And then every day is a day lived with the desire of pleasing God. And you invite God to direct you and you live with the awareness of the presence of God in your life every day. About a month ago, Paul Wortman spoke, and Paul very graciously declined. We typically pay an honorarium when a speaker speaks fills in for us here. And he said, I'll pass on my honorarium, but please take that money and buy some devotional books and give them away free to the people that are there. So if you were here on that day Paul spoke and got a devotional book, this is one, it's just a short couple paragraph thing that you can read every day. And I think if you want to have a rich relationship with God, you have to have some routine of nurturing your relationship with God. And reading a verse of the Bible and meditating on it is one way of doing that. And it will build your relationship. So we gave away all the books that we had bought. The honorariums aren't that high here, so we really couldn't buy very many of these things to give away. But we decided, we would just go a little above the honorarium thing out of generosity. And we bought a few more. And if you do not have one of these, we have a supply that we're going to give away to you free of charge. The bookstore price on this thing, I think I saw it here somewhere, $15.99 U.S., does that stir up any greed in you? Pick up if you don't have one, at this point I would say, one per family. But if we need one, we're not going to, out of God's gift, it's freely you have received, freely give. And so pick one up. Jesus is calling. And it's like the devotionals are written based on Jesus talking to you. And so it's a help. If you want to have a rich relationship with God, and I know you do, you have to nurture it. You have to do something about it. And to get a daily routine, and if you can't make it, as often as you can do it, just get started and you'll get better at it. And that's one way of nurturing your relationship to God. And we've got life groups coming up in the fall. Join a life group. Make sure you come to church Sunday. These are all ways of nurturing your relationship with God. Pray to God. And then we don't have to worry about what God's going to say to us when we meet Him in eternity. You know, what I really believe is God's going to say to all the Christians there, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of the Lord." That's the epitaph, the final word from Jesus. "Well done, good and faithful servant." Let's take full advantage of the grace and nurture our relationship with Him. Let's bow in prayer. Father, I pray that You would stir our hearts every day to nurture our relationship with You, knowing that that is the way to real life, to abundant life, the life in its fullness. So help us, Lord. Help us not to feel the self-condemnation of our failures. We surrender before You've paid for that at the cross. We thank You for that. Release us. You have released us from the penalty. Release us from the guilt and that which holds us back from enjoying Your grace and Your love, full measure. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Peter. That